Beautiful music this morning, Rufus Wainwright and Brandi Carlile singing Down in the Willow Garden. Rufus Wainwright will be performing at The Egg on Sunday, and you can find out more information by going to theegg.org, theegg.org. You can find the playlist posted, some great music coming up from that as well. Playlist posted online at wamc.org/roundtable, and those will be the tracks that we'll be playing throughout the morning. And we'll be talking to the executive director of The Egg later on today. They have a cool Eclipse after party going on Monday, so we'll be talking to her about that coming up. All right, let me invite you to be a part of the program and welcome you to the show. It's the 5th of April, 14 minutes past 9 o'clock, and we have a great group here, so let me introduce them to you. A reminder, you can always be a part of the program. All you have to do is write to us, panel at wamc.org, panel at wamc.org. Diplomat in residence at Bard College, Ambassador Fred Hoff joins us this morning. Hello, sir.
Hey, good morning, Joe. Good to be here.
Very nice to have you here. Thank you very much. Always a pleasure to have you on the panel. Nick Rangel joins us, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. Hello, Nick.
Hi, it's great to be here. And I just have to say, I learn about so many great artists listening to this channel and this show. And last week, I learned from being on the roundtable that Black Violin was playing like the next day. And then I went the next day and I had so much fun. So,
Funny. When I mentioned it, you were taking notes and I was like, oh, that's cool. Oh,
I immediately texted my husband. I was like, can we go to Black Violin tomorrow night?
Very
and then we did, and it was great.
That's the way it's supposed to work.
Yeah.
That's just an encapsulation of how all that promotion is supposed to work. Siena College professor of economics is Aaron Pasitti. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Good morning. That's what most people think in their heads when they hear the term economics. Blah, 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 hopefully I can add some clarity to that.
We welcome you. Again, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and it's we have a lot to talk about today. You know, two nights ago, I just had a bear of a time finding topics. It was hard, and not that there isn't a lot of stuff going on in the world, there is, but we have just discussed it a lot, and I thought, oh, God, this is... and then yesterday, well, we got all kinds of stuff to talk about. That's great. I was reading, if you'll indulge me for a second, last night I was going through stories and I found the story in the Boston Globe, a little known fact, today, April 5th, today marks the 50th anniversary of the publication of the first Stephen King novel, Carrie, published on this date 50 years ago.
Wow.
And so now that I am in this kidney stone-induced insomnia, I spent the night last night reading Carrie.
Did you finish it too?
I finished it. It was no help in moving the stones through, but it was.
Okay.
But it was really good. Really, really, really good. And I had forgotten how great it was. All right. Let's go to the story about the tensions between the President of the United States and the Prime Minister in Israel. And the word unacceptable being used. And we want to talk a little bit about what exactly that means. President Biden warning Netanyahu the situation in Gaza is unacceptable. President Biden told the Israeli Prime Minister on Thursday that the United States would reassess its policy towards the war in Gaza if the Jewish state does not take immediate steps to address the disastrous humanitarian situation in the enclave and protect aid workers. In the coming hours and days, we will be looking for concrete, tangible steps they are taking, according to White House National Security Spokesman John Kirby. The phone call between the two leaders came 3 days after seven workers from World Central Kitchen were killed by an Israeli strike on a clearly marked convoy, igniting outrage in the United States and abroad. The president held the call with Netanyahu specifically because of the deadly strike, according to Kirby, adding that Biden was, quote, shaken by the attack. In Thursday's call, Biden made clear the need for Israel to announce and implement a series of specific, concrete, and measurable steps to address civilian harm, humanitarian suffering, and the safety of aid workers. That according to a White House summary of the call, he made clear that U.S. policy with respect to Gaza will be determined by our assessment of Israel's immediate action on these steps. Fred Hoff.
Well, Joe, my reaction is one can't be 100% sure about these things, but wow, this looks and feels like a real turning point in this crisis.
I apologize if I'm interrupting. A turning point, or possibly an escalation?
I think a turning point. I mean, we have a number of things happening all at once now. President Biden made it very plain to Prime Minister Netanyahu in a very uneasy, tense 30-minute conversation that the United States is looking for certain things to happen, things that will happen quickly, things that are measurable, things that are mandatory for the United States not to change its policy approach. At the same time, you have a person who I consider to be the most competent senior official in the U.S. government, CIA Director Bill Burns,
mm-hmm.
Headed to Cairo for talks aimed at coming to an agreement on a 6-week ceasefire, potentially expandable to a permanent ceasefire. On top of that, you're seeing something that we really haven't seen since the beginning of this crisis, and that's some accountability on the Israeli side. There are reports that a couple of officers, at least a couple, have been relieved of their duties because of this attack that killed the seven World Central Kitchen people. And you know what this reminds me of is an old expression in the military, something I heard a million times as an Army officer, and that is that 10% never get the word.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem in the Israel Defense Forces seems to be that it's exactly the wrong 10% that doesn't get the word. These seven aid workers had clearance, had explicit clearance from the Israel Defense Forces to move in the direction they were moving in the Gaza Strip. And yet the word never got down to the Israeli personnel who were operating drones that these folks were to be given safe passage. Look, having served in the military, I think quite often We don't put enough weight on things being screwed up, on sheer incompetence. I think that's what we're seeing, and I think the IDF High Command is very much seized now with the problem that not all their wires are connected, and this has not been a good performance.
Should a call, I know it's probably impossible to answer a question like this, but it should a call similar to the one that took place yesterday should have taken place earlier?
Yes, I think the United States should have come to this point much earlier, mainly because our own foreign policy, our own standing and prestige in the Middle East region and beyond has been hurt very badly by the way Israel has waged this war. And saying that, I'm fully aware of the emotions that go into the Israeli effort. What happened on October 7th was dastardly and unspeakable, and yet the costs associated with trying to achieve Prime Minister Netanyahu's objective of putting Hamas out of business totally, militarily and otherwise, the costs have been just unacceptable.
Nick?
I think that this position is a little bit of a turning point, only because, the president has made several comments to Israel about protecting life and protecting civilians, but has not made any actual efforts or attempts or change in his own functional policy, right? We're still providing aid. There's news of this $18 billion sale of fighter jets and thousands of bombs that have gone forward. There's been no action change by Biden. So if this is the moment that actual change in his activities, then this is a change, kind of a pivotal moment. But I think the killing of these aid workers really demonstrates or provides this visual effect that the war in Gaza has been divorced from identifying and finding the hostages, because it's much harder to see drone strikes on aid vehicles and say this war is about hostages.
Right.
When you see that. And I think that is going to set a real tone change kind of across the board here.
Aaron.
Yeah, I want to come at this from a slightly different angle. And I kind of agree that if Biden follows through with what he was talking to Netanyahu about, I think what Joe pointed out is that this does risk escalation, which is a turning point in the war. And that escalation can really have dramatic economic consequences for the U.S. So I'm kind of, instead of looking at what's happening in Israel and Gaza and kind of bringing this into a more of a macroeconomic context, this probably poses one of the biggest risks to Biden's reelection campaign, both politically but also economically, because we've been here before in 1973, when Egypt and Syria invaded Israel and U.S. support poured into Israel. OPEC embargoed oil shipments to the U.S., quadrupling the price of oil, and that led to the fuel shortage and fuel rationing in the U.S. in the early 70s. It pushed the price of oil up dramatically so that U.S. businesses, and it wasn't just U.S. businesses, it was any supporting nation was subject to these embargoes. And what that does is it raises the cost of production to a point where not only do businesses have to raise prices, because oil's an input not only directly to things like gasoline, but also an intermediate input to any firm that distributes goods, that can lead to not only rising unemployment, but rising inflation, as businesses have to deal with both rising prices and lower profit margins. So they lay off workers, and that gave rise to the very ugly stagflation in the 1970s, which is slow growth coupled with inflation. Now, it's a little bit different this time around because the U.S. has doubled oil production in the past 10 years. So the U.S. is in a very different position to handle international oil price shocks. But if OPEC wanted to, the OPEC nations tend to be supportive of the Palestinian cause, OPEC could wage economic warfare at a very critical juncture in the summer when there's already upward pressure on oil prices because of summer travel. And they could intensify that, and that could make U.S. consumers and voters very unhappy because now they're facing higher prices at the pump. and it could damage Biden's reelection campaign. And then we all know what happens if that were to come to fruition. But on top of that, on top of just the possible OPEC response in terms of tightening the spigot, embargoing oil, driving up oil prices, which would frustrate U.S. consumers and hurt Biden's reelection chances, we also have the Houthi rebels, which are trying to snarl supply chains and just make it more expensive for people to for international shipping companies to transport all types of goods from, you know, one hemisphere to the other. So the inflation risk with escalation, I think, is very real, and that could have serious consequences for Biden's reelection campaign.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation on this issue. We already have several letters, and I'm sure by the time we come back, we'll have several more. We'll get to as many as we possibly can. To do that, if you can keep them short and to the point, that really helps us to get to as many as possible. And we appreciate your brevity, but also getting your point across. All you have to do is write to us at panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Fred Hoff, Nick Rangel, and Aaron Pacitti making up the panel this morning. We'll return after this break and news from the BBC.
High on a rocky ledge lives a middle-aged, shy as a shadow, lovely as lace and cold as ice. Time I climb up to paradise. How many times have I been up to see her? Goodness knows. Huffing and puffing, dressed in the warmest climbing clothes.
I love David Byrne. David Byrne performing with Rufus Wainwright. Rufus Wainwright, not David Byrne, but Rufus Wainwright will be at The Egg on Sunday, and you can find out more by going to theegg.org. As indicated, we have many letters. We will go through those, and we welcome yours. panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. Doc says, Hamas did what they did, knowing full well what Israel was going to do. Hamas doesn't care how many Palestinians or members of Hamas die. Their goal is to bring Israel down to their level, make Israel the baby killers, change world opinion, and recruit generations of new Hamas. Israel will have as much success destroying Hamas as we did with the Taliban. Israel is not going to defeat Hamas by following the battle plan Hamas has planned for Israel to take. Hamas is achieving their goal due to Israel's ruthless stupidity. That from Doc.
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that. Unfortunately, at the end of the day, when you try to look at things from the point of view of Sinwar and these other murderers. All they really need to do is survive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, surviving may not turn out to be as pleasant for them as they expect it to be. I suspect there are several hundred thousand Palestinian residents of the Gaza Strip who are not totally thrilled about the way they've been treated by Hamas.
We go to Larry. The initial investigation of the attack on the WCK convoy shows that the IDF identified gunmen among the convoy, leading to the misidentification of the vehicles. Every misstep by Israel is a zero-sum conclusion, while pro-Hamas falsehoods are recycled without second thought and are peddled in bad faith before Israel had a chance to rebut them.
This event shows why a sense of moral clarity in this conflict is so important. This war is the sum total of daily raw tragedies. The vast majority of the harshest criticism and all responsibility for this war belongs to Hamas. Hamas is evil. Hamas would rather sacrifice the civilian population of Gaza on the altar of its genocidal ambition and suicidal desires.
I think there are elements of that are correct. I certainly wouldn't disagree with the writer about the nature of Hamas. But I think what the writer ought to keep in mind is that the IDF itself is saying that a monumental screw-up reflecting grave incompetence took place, resulting in the deaths of these seven people. And I think there's another thing to take into account here. You know, right at the beginning of this conflict, a person who I know, a person who I consider to be extraordinarily well-educated, cultured, good judgment, the president of Israel, Isaac Herzog, made the statement that there is no such thing as an innocent Palestinian civilian. Okay, this sort of thing has been repeated in various forms by various Israeli officials, and I think what we need to take into account is when you get down to the level of an officer deciding whether to press the red button to activate an armed drone, or if you get down to the level of an IDF private with a rifle in his hands in the Gaza Strip, how do words like that get translated on the ground? Should there not have been a different message right from the beginning? Might Israel be in a different position today if the national leadership had emphasized the absolute necessity to try to protect civilian life under all circumstances?
You spoke of your respect for Isaac Herzog. Have you worked with him directly?
I've met him. I worked directly with his brother Mike, who is now Israel's ambassador in Washington. It's a fine family. Chaim Herzog was one of the founding fathers of Israel. Their dad. They are fine people, but it's a measure of how far the mutual dehumanization between Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs has gone. That you have people of this quality saying things that are just beyond regrettable.
Let's go to this letter from Karen. One cannot be an arsonist and a firefighter at the same time. The U.S. is complicit and needs to stop supporting military aid because they are afraid of the power of AIPAC.
Let me just make one comment on that, and it's something that I admit mystifies me. I'm reading in the press, and I have no way to confirm what's actually happened here, but I'm reading that we very recently shipped Israel something like 1,800 Mark 84 2,000-pound ground penetrating bombs. Now this ordnance was used to disastrous effect in terms of civilian casualties earlier in the conflict, and now we're sending more. And I think, I mean, if I were a journalist with access to senior administration officials, I'd be asking the questions: who approved this shipment? And since it was approved, what assurances were received from Israel that this particular ordinance would not be used in the Gaza Strip? anymore. I mean, Israel has other threats. The United States is certainly going to support the defense of Israel in the context of Iran, for example. There may be potential uses for this kind of bomb on other fronts, where you don't have a densely packed urban environment, where one of these things drop to maybe neutralize a half dozen Hamas operatives is going to kill several hundred people by bringing down an apartment building. But I would be interested in knowing whether our government has received any assurances from the government of Israel about the use or non-use of this particular weapon.
We go to Mark, who writes, yes, Biden is saying this is unacceptable, and yet saying through back channels to Netanyahu, make sure that check for $20 billion goes to the Treasury for the F-15 fighters deal. Please, I'm a Biden supporter, but words and actions differ from the White House on this.
I do think it'll be interesting to see what exactly is on the table when Netanyahu does not change real active policy, right? Because he doesn't show any interest in making significant changes, and we don't actually know what Biden demanded of him, right? The outlets are saying Biden demanded a list of things. We don't have the list, and said he would make changes in policy, but we don't have the list of the changes either. So it kind of feels a little empty without some accountability and transparency there.
Jonathan writes, didn't the acronym SNAFU originate in the armed forces? Competence is not a quality widely associated with armies, nor for that matter with human beings. We mess up. It's unavoidable. We should not be shocked when combatants are killed. Look at all the civilians, never mind aid workers, killed. That from Jonathan. Then Jolie says, hello, panel. Perhaps Netanyahu's objectives are destruction of Palestinians and a massive land grab. Destruction of Hamas is just an added benefit. That from Jolie. Then we go to Ralph, who writes, the idea that incompetence and miscommunication are the cause of this disaster does not hold water. Read between the lines of the IDF quote-unquote investigation. They claim they could not see the logos on the vehicles, yet could see a Palestinian, by the color of his skin, one assumes, carrying a bag, which apparently is enough to qualify for death in this conflict.
What the IDF is saying is that there was no excuse for this incident to take place. There was a failure in the IDF's own internal communications in terms of making sure that the right people had accurate information about these three vehicles and seven people.
More letters and more input from our panel when we return from a break. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Forty-six on a Friday morning on the 5th of April, and we welcome you to the roundtable. If you're just joining us, and if you've been around for a while, make yourself comfortable. We are talking about the situation in Gaza, the President of the United States warning the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, that the situation in Gaza is unacceptable. We've been getting many letters. I'll continue with those. We welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org. Irene says, so what I'm hearing from some letters is that because Hamas is playing an evil game, it's okay for Israel to kill many thousands of innocent people. This makes no sense to me. This kind of should not be supported by the American government. That from Irene. Anthony says, why does your panel never discuss the number of lies that the Israeli government tells about the war? No 40 beheaded babies, little proof of raped women, etc., etc. And all the Israelis seem to talk about is the 160 hostages they cannot find or the hostages they have killed. Why is that not getting more coverage? All I hear is a pro-Israel reporting bias. Israel is the fourth most powerful army in the world, yet we let them slaughter 35,000 Palestinians. Most of those casualties are civilians. I understand balanced reporting, but you are not balanced. You are showing preference for the dead Israelis and not the dead children of Gaza.
That's absolute nonsense. I mean, I respect the fact that the writer has a point of view of all of this, but on all of this, but I think he or she ought to be a bit more accurate in characterizing the views expressed on this panel.
Matt writes, that in light of the continued unnecessary killing of civilians by Israel, the U.S. should cease all aid to Israel, both weapons and otherwise. We spend a lot of effort to sanction terrorist organizations, and if the Israeli government will not immediately stop its indiscriminate killing and torture of the Palestinian people, at what point should it be designated a terrorist organization itself? Not the Israeli people, but specifically the Netanyahu government and military. We already sanctioned individual Israeli settlers that inflict violence on Palestinian citizens in the West Bank. So why not sanction Netanyahu himself and all military officials?
I think there's political liabilities with that. I mean, I don't envy President Biden's position, because if you draw a hard line on Israel and what they've been doing, then you run the risk of being labeled a, you know, supporter of Hamas. And you know, that's not going to fly with voters in an election year if, you know, Biden just puts unwavering support behind Israel, then he's, you know, now you're supporting baby killers. It's a tough position. And given the stakes in terms, again, not just the on the ground horrific civilian casualties that are being experienced by both sides, there's this larger issue that I have to imagine is in the back of Biden's head, where, you know, if he takes too strong a position, that can be a liability in an election year where the opponent is trying to make himself dictator for life. So, you know, trying to be nuanced and trying to appear, I don't want to say balanced, that's not the right word, but being sensitive to both sides, it's a strategic political play on his part. I don't know how this would work out differently if there was a different Republican candidate running for office. I don't know how different this would be if Biden was just, you know, a shoo-in for re-election. But I have to imagine that the election consequences and what, you know, going too far on either side could do, not only for his re-election campaign, but again, like I said before, there's the OPEC issue. And if OPEC wants to turn the spigots off, then you know, we could see $5-6 gas prices over the summer, and there goes Biden's chances of getting reelected.
Yeah, and what's interesting about that, I think, Aaron, is that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, the de facto ruler of the kingdom, is still exhibiting interest in the possibility of normalization with Israel. Okay. This is becoming increasingly difficult for him because Saudi public opinion, along with virtually 100% of Arab public opinion, is of the view that Israel is committing genocide in the Gaza Strip. And even authoritarians like Mohammed bin Salman have to pay attention to public opinion. And what I find interesting, reports that the Crown Prince had a telephone conversation with Donald Trump not very long ago.
Right.
And I wonder if in the course of the conversation, MBS said to Mr. Trump, "Hey, the Israelis are killing me here. The Israelis are killing me here. I really want to normalize with Israel. There are some things I need from the United States in order to do this. But as long as this nonsense in the Gaza Strip goes on, I can't take the next step."
Right.
So now all of a sudden you have the former president of the United States saying something to the effect of, well, you know, Israel ought to wrap this up quickly.
Yeah. And let's not, the Wall Street Journal had an excellent article. I can't remember if it was yesterday or 2 days ago, documenting Trump's reliance on Saudi money for a lot of his golf resorts. And for the former president who is extremely cash strapped, that's kind of a lifeline that Saudi Arabia has thrown to Trump in terms of this LIV golf league that Saudi Arabia is trying to do, but also pumping a lot of money from that to support Trump's golf clubs. You know, there's a transactional element to what's been happening.
You think so?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Let's go to Ian, who says, if Biden was seriously concerned about the innocent aid workers being killed and humanitarian crisis in Gaza, he'd withdraw arms supply and funds to Netanyahu's government. Full stop. Otherwise, this is all talk and the killing and crisis will continue.
Yeah, and this is what could be coming. And you know, one thing no one's mentioned in the letters yet, but I think it's worth mentioning. The killing of these seven Europeans, Americans, Canadians, just a god awful event, and hopefully it will result in a real change for the better very quickly. But I do understand the point of view of Palestinians who would say, oh, is this what it really takes? Over 20,000 civilians killed in the Gaza Strip, and yet it's the killing of seven Europeans and Americans that finally causes the president of the United States to have the kind of talk with Prime Minister Netanyahu he probably should have had long before.
Israel writes to us and says, addressing the tragic situation in Gaza, there has been no mention of Hamas's responsibility for the bloodshed. Indeed, the contrary is the case. They use the people as human shields. This is a war Hamas has brought upon its own people. They know Israel would respond to the attack. The situation was premeditated by Hamas.
That, you know, that's quite true. But it's also true that Israel essentially has gone along with this and helped Hamas achieve some important geopolitical objectives here.
And I think there's a parallel in terms of what happened on 9/11 and the Taliban drawing the U.S., baiting the U.S. into a swamp-like war in Afghanistan and Iraq. And the point is just to polarize and weaken the U.S. by spreading their military and political objectives as thin as possible in situations that are unwinnable no matter what you do. So Hamas, of course, knew what the response was going to be.
Sure.
They knew who was where the money was and the arms were going to come from in the response. Are they willing to tolerate it? Obviously, they have what's now called the axis of resistance with Iran and Syria and the Houthi rebels. The goal is to just draw, you know, weaken the empire, and by drawing them into these situations that are costly financially, costly in terms of political capital, costly in terms of further polarizing politics in the U.S., to make it so that the empire just gets weakened, and that this might not be a short-term objective. This might be similar to what, you know, the Taliban did. This is, I think, strategically probably a much longer-term objective that they have.
Yeah, I just, you know, I think we get a lot of those letters, but I feel like it's because there's a baseline acceptance and acknowledgement that Hamas is to blame for triggering this cascade of events, that they did the thing on purpose. They are a terrorist organization. They do terrorist things. And we don't talk about their role and what they've done wrong here because we're not paying them for it. We're not contributing the funds to their activities. We aren't their partners and allies. We aren't committed to maintaining their, you know, governance and identity as a nation. You know, we have a relationship with Israel that is different than our relationship to Hamas, and therefore the feedback and thoughts and, you know, conversation around Israel's activities with both our allyship and the funds we contribute to it are going to be different than how we talk about our relationship to Hamas.
We have one more letter I want to get to, and then we'll take a break at the top of the hour and we'll move on to other subjects in our 10 o'clock hour. Lawrence writes, is it possible that there is a contingent within the IDF which is bloody-minded, not interested in rules of engagement, and bent on killing and destroying everything and everyone within Gaza?
I think that's kind of what Fred said, was that there are some extremist views within Israel's leadership and likely within its ranks, where it's a shoot first, ask questions later mentality. That wouldn't be avoidable, and or unexpected.
And I wouldn't underemphasize the sheer fear that soldiers have in a situation like that in some cases will cause them to shoot first and ask questions later. There were three Israeli hostages killed by mistake by IDF soldiers several months ago.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll move on, and we welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org, First News with Ray Graff.
Oh, Shenandoah, I long to hear you. Oh.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Great group assembled, and we'll go through most of this hour talking about more issues. Fred Hoff is here, Nick Rangel, Aaron Pasitti. I'm Joe Donahue. We always welcome your letters, panel@WAMC.org. WAMC, panel@WAMC.org. I do just want to quickly mention this. because we were talking about letters. But before we completely leave Israel and that subject for today, there has been a call for elections to be held, and I would just like to talk about that. A member of Benjamin Netanyahu's war cabinet, highlighting the domestic pressure that he is under, has made a call for early elections. How does that figure into the equation?
Well, if you look at polling data in Israel, you find a couple of 75% readings that are quite interesting. 75% of Israelis would like to see Benjamin Netanyahu removed as prime minister. 75% of Israelis oppose the creation of a Palestinian state. So what Bibi Netanyahu's basic strategy has been is, keep the war going in Gaza, on the theory that that Israelis will be reluctant to unseat a wartime leader, while at the same time trying to reach out to that 75% of Israelis who at least currently are of the opinion that a Palestinian state would be a security threat to Israel. I think there are Israelis, Benny Gantz, retired general, is a person who is a bit right of center, have come to the conclusion that that Netanyahu is just not the answer to what Israel needs right now. He was the one primarily responsible for the IDF being unprepared for what happened last October 7th. He's already been deeply controversial in his current term because of attempts to change the way Israel's judicial system operates. So Benny Gantz agreed to help out the prime minister by becoming part of his war cabinet, but he is of the view that there should be an election this September. Otherwise, there's not one, I think, until October 2026.
October 2026.
Yeah. So even if but a number of things have to fall into place. Even if Benny Gantz were to withdraw from the war cabinet, Netanyahu would still have a coalition of 64 members out of the Knesset's total of 120. So someone else would have to fall out in order for a successful vote of no confidence to take place in the Knesset, or Bibi would voluntarily resign, which I understand is not likely because it would expose him to the full force of judicial prosecution that he faces.
All right. Let's go to elections in this country where things are much more settled. Remember the No Labels Party? Everybody was worried about the No Labels Party. And what would that mean for Democrats? What would that mean for Republicans? What would that mean for the overall election? And so the party, the group, the centrist group, as they call themselves, No Labels, announced yesterday that they have abandoned their ambitions for a third party candidate. They have failed to find candidates who had a credible path to victory in the November elections. The group said in a statement, Americans remain more open to an independent presidential run and hungrier for unifying national leadership than ever before. But No Labels has always said we could only offer our ballot line to a ticket if we could identify candidates with a credible path to winning the White House. No such candidate emerged. So the responsible course of action is for us to stand down. The group had gained ballot access in 21 states, claimed to have a clear way of getting on the ballot in the remaining states once candidates were nominated. But the group struggled to find anyone with significant stature who was willing to take on the role in the face of significant opposition from Democrats who believed the No Labels effort would help elect former President Donald Trump. So you just sort of see them having a meeting going, oh, what about, no, we don't. Nick.
Yeah, the reality is that anyone who has a credible chance of winning a presidential election has had to climb the ranks within a established party by both demonstrating, some level of loyalty by being committed to that party over some period of time, likely decades, and having held office on a party line at local or state level positions. And so that, I think the mission to find someone who would be able to run a strong campaign against established parties, leave the party that got them to become a person who has a credible chance at winning at a national level, and be able to bring the donors who got them to their national standing in the first place out of their party and over to this No Label group. I mean, it just seems like a tremendous undertaking, a really, really big lift. I don't know how this would ever happen.
Yeah, I think there's probably two. There's a short-term and a long-term issue with these third-party candidate decisions. Economists like competition, but apparently we don't like competition when it comes to politics. We've had a duopoly for the last, how many centuries. There's two parties. They compete against themselves. You either get this one or that one. Now, there's variations within the party. You've got the Freedom Caucus on the right. And then you've got the Green New Deal folks on the left. So it's not that they're, I think we're starting to see more nuance within those two parties where you've got, the centrist wing, the hard, the hard right and the hard left wing, and then people who are more in the middle. So the short term issue is circumstantial, is that who the Republicans are putting forward presents a legitimate risk to democracy and the functioning of long-standing institutions, who has made it very clear his objective is to make himself, ruler for life. So not running a candidate is a strategic move in the short run. But I think structurally, and this is somebody who's sympathetic to third-party candidates, we've got two parties that are beholden to the donor class. There is, you can call them oligarchs because that's what they are. They speak through their contributions. They speak through the economic power that they leverage, and they've got significant funds invested in both parties. If you look at the distribution of campaign contributions pre-Trump, and I am calling them oligarchs because that's what they are, would more or less split their donations evenly between Republicans and Democrats. So no matter who wins, they're going to have a voice in policy. They probably favor Republicans because they're more in favor of, lower taxes and less regulation. But at the same time, oligarchs have these long-term objectives, and you can't completely ignore things like funding for education and infrastructure that allow them to, conduct whatever business they have. It's not surprising to see in such a polarized atmosphere that a centrist candidate just can't get any momentum. I don't know what happened. When was the last time we had a viable third party candidate? Was it Ross Perot that was actually on a debate stage and garnered
somewhat viable? Yes.
Somewhat viable.
Well, I think the last time we had a truly viable third party candidate was when Teddy Roosevelt ran as a progressive. Bull Mooser in 1912, something like that.
So
he could have actually won.
Right. Yeah. Perot was just, I don't know what his objectives were. And then you have Bloomberg. But, all of these people who run on these independent tickets, whether it's with the No Label Party or not, also appear to be very independently wealthy. And I think that just proves the point is that, you know, like politicians, you know, their language is money. Their currency is money in the form of campaign contributions, in terms of promising favors. So, you know, just because No Labels isn't running a party doesn't mean there isn't a third party candidate out there who's mixing things up with his, you know, I don't know, some type of mental confusion in terms of how he's approaching this. But I digress.
Yeah, and one of the, you know, one of the big impacts of third parties historically in the United States is that eventually one or both of the major parties tries to reach out to the people who are attracted to the third party. I mean, it's interesting. 6 months ago, I think the No Labels folks were pretty confident they could put up a viable candidate for the presidency, and what they were working on was the fact that is still true, that a strong majority of Americans does not wish to have to choose between Biden and Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you know, speaking personally, I wish I had had the opportunity to vote for Governor John Huntsman for president. Remarkably skilled individual, former governor of Utah, ambassador to China under President Obama, ambassador to Russia under President Trump, an enormously capable individual. But he was one of several who in the end said no. And I think his main fear was, you know, can we really get enough traction in the American electorate to make us something more than a poison pill that is going to put Trump in the White House?
I think it's I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. I think independent candidates. Really independent candidates are a really great way to elevate or amplify, topics or issues that mainstream candidates are trying to avoid or don't really want to shed a lot of light on. They do add quite a bit of debate to, you know, the conversation around each candidate's campaign, but we would need real structural change to our campaign finance systems, our electoral systems, to have real third party or multiple party elections.
Yeah, I think what's happened, I know what's happened over the past 40 years has been just widening inequality, where the gains from economic growth are just accruing to the richest 1%, and people have finally gotten wise to that game, that the economy doesn't work for them, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican in office. Biden has kind of changed that narrative in ways that we won't see pay off for a couple years. But it's clear, and you saw this in 2016, when voters were just begging for some type of populist candidate, whether it was the support for Bernie on the left or the support for Trump on the right. It was clear that the rise in inequality, the decline in upward economic mobility, stagnating real wages, the rising cost of education, the American dream is growing increasingly out of reach for a lot of people. And Bernie and Trump both tap that vein to great success. So I think voters are wise to the game that they live in a world where the economy is stacked against them. 99% of the population is just at the mercy of the richest 1%. So it seems like this is a good time for an independent candidate who is able to kind of harness that populism without some of the bombast that we see on either side. But there are just structural obstacles, and it really has to do with the role of private money in politics. It's not, like you pointed out, the ideas are great, and like Fred pointed out with Huntsman, these ideas are great, but like, can they gain any traction? How do they gain traction? They gain traction with money, and that's how they get a little momentum.
But I mean, that's kind of that's kind of the problem, right? How are we looking to Trump as a populist candidate who is going to change the wealth distribution from the 1% back to the middle class? It's make believe, and even third party candidates, we've already said they're pretty much all independently wealthy people. So mm-hmm. we're looking to an independent person for some wealthy quality shifts in our economic policy. And that those two things just don't coincide. They don't work.
Trump passed no populist policy while in office. His message that appeals to voters is the populist message of, like, we need to rebuild the middle class. We need to make America great again. We need to restrict immigration. It's a right-wing populist message. He did nothing. He passed a $1.5 trillion tax cut for corporations and millionaires and billionaires. That was his, major legacy.
Meanwhile, speaking of bombast and candidates with money, RFK Jr. has been in the news twice this week. We covered the first go-round, if you will, regarding his comments that he eventually sort of kind of tried to walk back about how President Biden would be more dangerous to democracy than Donald Trump. Then, to follow up for his second act, the campaign told supporters Wednesday that those facing charges in the January 6th Capitol riot are, quote, activists sitting in a Washington, D.C. jail cell stripped of their constitutional liberties. The Kennedy campaign used the language in an email urging his followers to sign a petition calling for the release of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. In the email titled "We Must Free Assange," the campaign compared those jailed for their actions on January 6 to Julian Assange and Edward Snowden, a former NSA contractor who leaked information about top secret U.S. surveillance programs and is now living in Moscow. Now, here's where it just gets fun. The campaign claimed Thursday that Kennedy did not approve of the wording in the email, blaming the quote-unquote error on a contractor who the campaign later said has since been terminated. But Kennedy himself has previously downplayed the January 6th attack and said he is opening to pardoning convicted rioters. The email sent from Team Kennedy refers to a British court's decision to delay Assange's extradition to the United States until he has guaranteed free speech protections and U.S. officials offer assurances that he will not incur the death penalty in a U.S. trial.
I just want to say, stripped of your constitutional liberties is just a fancy way of saying you're incarcerated for having committed crimes. Like, yeah, you don't have liberties when you are incarcerated for having committed crimes. I don't know what the controversy is with saying that. You are incarcerated and you've committed crimes. But I think what's funny, I mean, there's so many things that are funny. I don't even know where to start.
Sad.
I was like, sad, just bizarre, just wild is here's this person with this like very lengthy, successful legal career who is constantly embroiled in these bizarre conspiracy theory conversations. And it just blows my mind every time one of these announcements come out.
The the naming of defendants as activists comes very close to hostages, right? I mean, the wording that Donald Trump is using in his campaign and aligning himself with the January 6th rioters, calling them patriots and hostages. And this earlier in the week when we talked about this, we talked about, if someone is going to vote for RFK, who does that take votes away from? Does it take votes away from Trump? Does it take votes away from Biden. And
I think it depends on the week. Yeah. Depends on what bombastic thing he says. And you can see the response from both of those campaigns with each of those sort of moments in time as well. When he is connecting better with Biden supporters, the Biden campaign responds with, some attacks. And when he is more aligned with Trump supporters, Trump's campaign responds with more attacks and is kind of this zigzag approach.
Yeah, I think so far it looks like RFK Jr. Is poised to whatever percentage of the vote he ends up with. It, as of now, it looks like he's dragging 50-50 from both Trump and Biden. I have two reactions to this. First, as someone who still very deeply mourns the passing of Bobby Kennedy, I just find RFK Jr.'s participation in our national political scene to be extraordinarily regretful. But beyond that, what struck me was a figure I saw in one of today's news stories that, according to polls, about 55% of Americans, 55%, saw what happened and see what happened on January 6th, 2021, as a violent attempt to stop the constitutional transfer of presidential power, one that involved attacks on American police officers defending the Capitol. 55%.
Only 55%.
Yeah. We'll hold there. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll wrap up the program for this Friday edition. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the roundtable. So while we were sitting here and talking about things, we had an earthquake, and in the Northeast, it's affected New York surrounding areas. I believe it's been felt as south, at least initial reports, as far south as Washington D.C. and as far north as Montreal, and minor. Of course, and people are calling the station and reporting the shaking that took place. 4.8 is what we've been told on the magnitude of the quake. And I don't know about my fellow panelists. I didn't feel anything. I think I'm just always jittery in my chair when I'm doing this show. Yeah. I don't know that I would have noticed an earthquake. But people outside of the studio said that they felt it. So early reports are that things are fine and no major issues.
But it appears the epicenter is in Jersey, which would be typical.
Yeah. Well, right. Yeah. It's... go ahead, David.
Yeah, we all felt it in the newsroom. We were sitting there, and the decks started moving a bit, and someone in a studio said the microphone started shaking. And your own engineer, Rob Chacon, thought somebody was moving something heavy upstairs.
Wow. I thought I was just kicking my legs.
I feel pretty safe in here, though, if that was
bunker.
We were engrossed. We were very, involved in this.
So laser focused on Kennedy.
What a damn earthquake, and that wouldn't get my kidney stone out.
Damn it.
All right.
Will nothing help?
Come on. All right. So we'll obviously be covering this more throughout the Newsday. We'll have news and also, of course, Midday Magazine, and look more into the earthquake that has impacted the Northeast. I know as a reporter, when I was started here, was reporting that whenever you would have some sort of seismic activity, you immediately go down to the State Museum, where they have the what's that thing, Fred?
Tunnel?
No, they have the measuring.
Oh, the seismic. The,
yeah, thing? Yeah, and they can tell you can see it. You can see where the needle goes up and down, and that's always kind of fascinating to see. But 4.8 happening at 10:23 p.m. That will teach us to talk about RFK. All right.
Well, I wonder, you know. Brian Glenn is dating Marjorie Taylor Greene, and he recently made comments along the lines of, like, the eclipse is, you know, a sign that the American public is having a spiritual awakening to the evil in the country. And I wonder what we're going to hear about the earthquake and eclipse in the same week.
Well, it's,
whoa.
Well, obviously Biden engineered this to be able to promote his infrastructure plan and how we need to prepare ourselves. So that's my take on it.
The New York Times reporting that a magnitude 4.8 earthquake shook buildings across the New York City region shortly after 10:20, and that according to the U.S. Geological Survey. So, again, we'll have much more going on coming up in Midday Magazine and throughout the day. All right. Aaron Pasitti?
Mm-hmm.
It has come to the U.S. jobs report. We have another burst of hiring for the month of March. Employers added 303,000 jobs, according to the Labor Department. The 39th straight month of job growth. Take it away, Aaron.
So, the first Friday of every month, when the Bureau of Labor Statistics releases their employment situation summary.
And by contract, Aaron is here.
Yes, by contract. Yeah, uh-huh. For 39 months, economists have just been surprised, pleasantly surprised, by just how strong the job market remains. So this month, last month in March, the economy added 303,000 jobs. That was above the 200,000 forecast. It was above the 270,000 jobs added in February, and it was well above the 231,000 jobs averaged over the past 12 months. So by any metric, the U.S. labor market continues to grow at rates that are far stronger than any economist predicted at the beginning of COVID, in the middle of COVID, and even up until now when economists have just been saying, a recession has to be right around the corner. The Fed's raised interest rates from 0 to 5.3%. How is this not affecting the unemployment rate? And that is a question that economists continue to ponder because, I hate to say this, we don't have any good answers right now. So part of the job growth is just due to the bounce back and rebound from COVID, right? The unemployment rate shot to 14% in the spring of 2020. Those jobs bounced back. There was a lot of pent-up consumer demand that was released during that period that created labor shortages and just the hiring spree by employers. That has subsequently calmed down, but yet the job growth remains. So obviously part of that is due to some of Biden's fiscal policies, the American Rescue Plan being the initial one that kept that momentum going, the CHIPS Act, the Inflation Reduction Act. All of these are pro-growth, pro-employment policies. So what we've seen really for the past year is that wages, which grew 4.1% last month, are now well in excess of the 3% inflation rate. So workers for about the past year have been experiencing income growth that exceeds the increase in the cost of living. GDP growth continues to exceed forecasts. Inflation has come down from its peak of 9% to right around 3%. So by every metric, by every data source, no matter which way you slice it and dice it, the U.S. economy is growing at a very high and very sustainable path. But what I want to kind of do is link this back to what we were talking about before with some of the political consequences. Yes. And what there's a disconnect between what I just said and what the average person is feeling. Consumer sentiment is just starting to bounce back. Consumer sentiment plummeted despite the fact that jobs are abundant. The unemployment rate is at a 50-year low. Inflation has come down. Wage growth is up. So that disconnect, consumers feeling that the economy is not working for them, partially reflects their political preferences. In a polarized political environment, when a Democrat's in office, no matter what happens, Republicans feel like bad. It's just a bad world out there. Democrats, to a lesser extent, feel that when a Republican's in office, but it's a very asymmetrical response where Republicans tend to promote and feel the bad news more than Democrats do. So what we have is a situation that has been exacerbated by TikTok stories, which give credence to more economic bad news than good news, political messaging coming from the Trump campaign about just how bad the economy is, and that is in direct conflict with the reality. So earlier this week, the Wall Street Journal conducted a poll in swing states asking voters, is inflation moving in the right direction? Inflation measures the change in the cost of living. 74% of voters in swing states think that inflation has gone up over the past year when it has come down from 9% to 3%. So there's a disconnect between how people feel about the economy and what's happening with the economy. And I would love to take credit for this adage, but Paul Krugman was the one who invented it, where, you know, pre-Trump, we would say seeing is believing. If you see the data, if you see the job growth, if you see prices stabilizing, then you believe the economy is moving in the right path. In this post-truth political environment, believing is seeing. If you believe that inflation is going up, then the economy is bad. That is your reality, that this is an economy that is one where we have rising prices. The unemployment rate is artificially suppressed by Biden's hacks in the Bureau of Labor Statistics and so on. But there's a bigger issue, and I know we're running short on time, but getting back to this concept of third-party candidates and the rise of populism, there are very good grounds for pessimism about the U.S. economy. We have the highest level of income and wealth inequality since the 1920s, where the bulk of economic gains, the benefits of economic policy primarily accrue to millionaires and billionaires. This is where we're in a generation where people are more likely to have a lower standard of living than their parents. So downward economic mobility is more likely than upward economic mobility. Healthcare costs, education costs, housing costs are just out of reach for most people. Firms are exerting more market power because we have monopolies and oligopolies that are able to raise prices independent of economic conditions. Job quality is going down. So people have reason to be upset, but what they're upset about are policies that Republicans have intensified, particularly under the Trump administration, with lax regulation, not enforcing antitrust laws, tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. And we're in this Orwellian world where you say, see, the economy's not working for you, but it's not because we're giving trillion-dollar tax cuts to billionaires and not investing in infrastructure and healthcare and education, but it's because of Biden's, you know, pro-inflation policies.
Aaron, I got a question. I mean, I agree with you. Seeing ought to be believing, mm-hmm. for sure. But if you're an American not unlimited means, and you're going to the grocery store, mm-hmm. and you're looking at the prices of the stuff you usually buy to support your family. You go to fill up your car. Is it so unreasonable for these folks to believe that inflation is still very much with us?
Sure. Inflation measures the total basket of goods that an average consumer buys.
Right.
But consumers focus on two prices primarily when they think about how the economy is performing. Gas prices, which have come down from their $5 peak in the spring of 2022 to, you know, under $3. So massive reduction in gas prices. So now what they're focusing on are grocery prices. And grocery prices have been going up faster than the average. But that's concentrated in, you know, you look at eggs, the price of milk. It's, you know, a handful of goods. So that's true. The root cause of that problem, there's three root causes of that problem. There's the short-term one, which is Putin's invasion of Ukraine, which destroyed, I mean, Ukraine exports, what, 25% of the world's grain, which goes into a lot of processed foods. So there's a shortage of grain pushing up the price of groceries. Climate change, floods and droughts makes crop yields less reliable. So you have massive crop destruction, which is more of a slow boil on the increase of grocery prices. But the biggest issue, the biggest long-term issue, and one that can be solved through political action, is the market concentration. We've got really 10 major food producers. You've got Unilever, Nestle, Coca-Cola, Pepsi. These are giant corporations who are able to either shrink product sizes and charge the same price or jack up prices. So consumers are right to feel the pinch with grocery prices. It's that their attention and their identification of the root cause of the problem is misguided. It's not due to Biden policies. It's due to other policies.
Nick, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering at what point will consumer activity start to shift? So if we know that part of the increase in cost is related to these food producers, much of that is processed food. At what point do people say, well, maybe I'll rely less on the processed food and try to shift my purchasing habits? Yeah. And I know that's an upward battle because of just the tremendous amount of advertising, the cultural norms and all of that. But there are, you know, opportunities to mm-hmm. change what you're buying, right? I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
People don't like change.
Yeah.
You know, you're right. I mean, you can alter the basket of goods that you buy, but, you know, for things like, you know, meat and dairy and eggs, a lot of people rely on that and getting them to, you know, eat even vegetables are more expensive now, so.
But the frozen foods, I think those have the greatest increase,
sure.
Proportionately in cost. Like, those are getting more expensive faster than fresh mm-hmm. foods and not processed food options, but we're still seeing such a big share of frozen, yeah. boxed, processed, you know, pre-made items in that basket.
We're going to end it there. You know, I think we've done enough damage with an earthquake and all, but we'll bookmark it here for today. My thanks to our incredible group and their thoughtful. That was a really good conversation on all fronts. Kudos, Aaron, on your jobs report as always. Wonderfully done.
Thank you.
And thank you all for your thoughtfulness. Fred Hoff, Nick Rangel, Aaron Pasitti, have a beautiful weekend, and thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you,
we'll be back right after this.